Okay. So as you can see, the title is, does perception indicate that its objects are momentary or persisting? And we're going to be looking at a debate between Jayanta and Rabhigupta. Jayanta, we could say, was a Hindu, although that's a slightly anachronistic thing to say, because in Jayanta's period, the 9th century, there was no concept of Hinduism yet. His tradition was Nyaya, and Rabhigupta was a Buddhist who lived about 100 years before Jayanta. So the general topic is the Buddhist theory of momentariness. What was that? Well, in the sermons of the Buddha, recorded in the Pali canon, the Buddha taught that everything is transitory. And that idea of the transitoriness of everything became further radicalized in later Buddhism to the momentariness of everything. And after a certain time in the history of Indian Buddhism, almost all, but not quite all, of the various streams of Indian Buddhism accepted this theory of momentariness. Now, I said momentariness was more radical than transitoriness. What did I mean by that? Well, to say that everything is transitory is just to say that eventually everything will cease. But to say that everything is momentary is to say that everything ceases after a single moment. So this is what the theory of momentariness holds, that nothing actually lasts for more than a single moment. So the whole universe is constantly new in every single moment. Whether we're talking about states of mind, or people, or external objects, nothing exists for more than a moment. Everything, rather, consists of rows of discrete, numerically different objects, but each one resembles the previous one so closely and succeeds it so rapidly that we think we're looking at continuously existing things. This phone may seem, as we concentrate on it over time, to persist over time, but actually there's one phone moment existing in this moment, and in the next moment it's a different phone moment, and so on. So everything is in process. There are no stable, enduring substances. Everything is in process, where process is envisaged as rows of discrete entities. Now, we're going to look at the debate between Jayanta and Rabhigupta concerning this theory of momentariness. We'll first look at the Buddhist argument, which Jayanta attributes to Rabhigupta. Then we'll look at Jayanta's argument. And for those two sections, I'll be drawing on a particular passage within Jayanta's text called the Nyaya Manjari, written at the end of the 9th century, where Jayanta first gives the Buddhist argument that he attributes to Rabhigupta, then gives his own contrary argument. And then in the third part of my talk, I'll just give my conclusion. My conclusion will be that actually neither the Buddhist argument nor Jayanta's argument is successful. Now, the particular Buddhist argument for momentariness that we'll be looking at here is unusual for proofs of momentariness in this period, because by this period, most Buddhist proofs of momentariness drew on some version of Dharmakirti's inference of momentariness, which was called the Sattva Anumana, the inference of momentariness from existence, Sattva, where what Dharmakirti did was define existence in a certain way, in a not implausible way, and then showed how nothing can actually meet that definition. he shows through elaborate argumentation that there's nothing other than, I said nothing, I meant nothing other than momentary things. Nothing non-momentary can meet that definition of existence. Therefore, it follows that everything that exists is momentary. But this Buddhist proof of momentariness that we'll be looking at does not draw on Dharmakirti's argumentation. It says, rather, that we can arrive at the conclusion of momentariness just by reflecting on perception, just by reflecting on what's involved in perception, we can reach the conclusion that perception grasps momentary objects. So, that's the overall structure of the talk. Let's now look at this Buddhist argument. So the first premise of the argument is that perception accesses only the present, neither the past nor the future. Second premise, the present lasts just one moment. So what is the conclusion that's going to validly follow from those two premises? Exactly. Perception accesses just a single moment. And that is how the Buddhist sometimes states the conclusion of their argument. But actually, at other times, the Buddhist states the conclusion in a slightly different way, namely that perception grasps an object that lasts just one moment. And we'll come back to that difference later. First, I just want to diagrammatically represent the different views. So, this figure one is the Buddhist view, where the eye represents a moment of perception, and the parallel lines stretching out from the eye indicate that the range of that perception is just one moment. Those vertical lines going up span one moment. And the fact that the line at the top does not extend to the left beyond that horizontal, that vertical line, and does not extend to the right beyond the right-hand vertical line, indicates that the object of perception lasts for just one moment. Now, figure two is the Nyaya view, where we no longer have the lines in parallel, indicating that perception can grasp more than just the present moment. And that diagram, figure two, can represent either a denial of the first Buddhist premise or a denial of the second Buddhist premise. That diagram in figure two can either represent the view that perception accesses more than the present, it also accesses the immediate past and the immediate future, or it can represent the view that perception accesses the present, but the present is extended, and the present lasts for more than one moment. And in fact, Jayanta disputes both of the two premises of the Buddhist argument. So it might sound surprising, but Jayanta actually holds both that the present lasts for more than one moment and that perception can grasp more than just the present. But what I wanted to point to here is the existence of this possible view given in figure three, where this is not a view that has come up yet in the argumentation, but the long line, the long horizontal line in figure three, indicates that the object of perception existed before the present moment and continues to exist after the present moment. So this is not a view that the Buddhist is going to accept. The Buddhist will have to rule out this view. But actually, nothing that the Buddhist has argued so far has yet ruled out that view. The Buddhist argument so far has ruled out the figure two view, but it hasn't actually ruled out this figure three view, because the figure three view accepts both of the Buddhist premises and accepts what is validly entailed by those two premises. What's validly entailed by those two premises is that the present accesses only the one present moment. Well, the fact that in figure three the two lines are horizontal indicates an acceptance of that.
So it accepts that perception axis is only one moment, but it nevertheless claims that the object of perception is not momentary. So what that shows, what the existence of figure three as a possible view shows, is that the Buddhist argument does not actually conclusively prove momentariness yet. Now, you'll remember that I said that the Buddhist formulates the conclusion in two different ways. The Buddhist speaker in this text sometimes refers to the conclusion as that perception axis is just one moment, but at other times states the conclusion as that perception grasps an object that lasts just one moment. And the first main point I want to make is that there's a significant difference between these two claims. One is validly entailed by the two Buddhist premises, two is not. The figure three view that we looked at is compatible with one, but it's not compatible with two. Because that figure three view accepted that we access just one moment, but denied that the object lasts for just one moment. One is a weaker claim, two is a stronger claim. One is a purely epistemological claim, two is an ontological or metaphysical claim. One is just about the range of perception, two is about the temporal duration of objects of perception. And so the question that comes to the fore is, why does the Buddhist speaker think that they can just change freely between these two formulations? Why does the Buddhist speaker seem to think that one entails two? And how could the Buddhist move from one to two? How can the Buddhist move from the purely epistemological claim in one to the ontological claim in two? Or to put that question in a slightly different way, how can the Buddhist rule out the possibility of this view, represented in the diagram at the top, and thus arrive exclusively at this view in the diagram at the bottom, as the only possibility? So that's a question we're going to bear in mind. Now, I want you to envisage a situation where you're staring at some object, let's say a table, with unwavering gaze, that means you're not blinking, and unwavering concentration, your mind is not wandering. You manage that for a few moments, more than one moment. And during that time, the table doesn't appear to change at all. What will the Nyayaka say about this, and what will the Buddhist say about this? Nyayaka is an adherent of Nyaya, such as Jayanta. Well, the Nyayaka will say this provides very firm evidence that the table in 2-1 is exactly the same as the table in T2. The Buddhist will actually deny that and say that even in that situation, what is happening, George finds this very funny, what is actually happening is, in fact, we are perceiving one table moment in T1 and a totally different table moment in T2. Because the Buddhist will say to the Nyayaka, perception is momentary, and even you Nyayakas accept that perception is momentary. That's why I've drawn two eyes in the Nyaya diagram rather than one extended eye. Because for Nyaya also, actually, perception is momentary. These momentary perceptions, they inhere in a persistent self for Nyaya. But Nyaya maintains, actually, that perception is momentary, different perception in each moment. So the Buddhist says to the Nyayaka, even in this case of unwavering gaze and concentration where no break in the table is detected, you Nyayakas, just like us Buddhists, you should actually accept that you're looking at one table moment in T1 and a different table moment in T2, because you Nyayakas also claim that we're dealing with two separate perceptions. We're dealing with two separate perceptions. They should be limited in their range of what they can access, so they should be accessing distinct objects. Now, the Nyayaka will not agree to that, but we can see that the issue has now become, can one moment of perception ever allow us to know that its object is the same as the object of the previous moment of perception? In other words, can perception in T2 ever allow us to know that the T1 object is the same as the T2 object? The Nyayaka will say, of course, why not? The Buddhist will say, no, we're dealing with a different object in T2 because the T2 perception didn't exist at the time of T1. So the T2 perception has no way of knowing that its object is the same as the object in T1. Well, it seems to me that now there are two paths that the Nyayaka can take. Either the Nyayaka can argue that we can know that two consecutive perceptions have the same object. Perhaps the Nyayaka could appeal here to the fact that these two perceptions inhere in one persistent subject. Or, perhaps even more troublingly for the Buddhist, the Nyayaka can point out that if we can't know that two consecutive perceptions have the same object, then we can't know that they have different objects. So if it's the case, as the Buddhist claims, that two consecutive perceptions can't be known to have the same object because the second perception doesn't have access to what the object was in the earlier moment, then it should also follow that that perception in T2 cannot know that its object is different from the T1 object. So ironically, it seems like the Buddhist, by shrinking the range of perception down to one moment, has actually precluded the possibility of establishing momentariness. Because it should follow, if perception cannot know that its object is the same as the previous moment, it should equally follow that it can't know that its object is different, i.e. it can't know that objects of perception are momentary. So the Buddhist is aware of this problem. How do they get out of this difficulty? Well, the Buddhist at this point appeals to what I call quasi-idealism, by which I mean these two claims. The Buddhist asserts at this point that to exist is to be perceived, and to not be perceived is to not exist. So the fact that this kind of idealism is required at this point in this argumentation means that this particular argument is not going to be available to a Buddhist who doesn't espouse this kind of idealism. This argument will not be open even to some in the Dharmakirtian tradition, like Dharmottara, who does not believe in this kind of idealism. So this is a particular proof of momentariness which is only available to Buddhists who espouse this kind of idealism. I'm calling it quasi-idealism rather than full-blown idealism, because to say that to exist is to be perceived is not quite the same as saying that to exist is to be of the nature of perception. So I think these two claims, the second of which looks like it's just straightforwardly entailed by the first, fall slightly short of full-blown Yogacara idealism, according to which to exist is to be of the nature of consciousness, to exist is to be of the nature of perception. That's not quite claimed here. Now, I said that the Buddhist here appeals to this kind of idealism to get them out of the problem that we saw on the previous slide, but how does it do that? Can I ask someone at the back to get me a glass of water?
Thanks.
So how is it that this quasi-idealism gets the Buddhist out of the problem? Well, if non-perception means non-existence, let's just go back and remind ourselves of
the second claim here is that to not be perceived is to not exist. That means non-perception equals non-existence. Thanks. If that's the case, if non-perception means non-existence, well then since the object of perception at T1 is not perceived at T2, we can know that it does not exist at T2.
Let me explain that again.
At T2, the T2 perception does not perceive what was perceived at T1. Perception at T2 doesn't grasp what was perceived at T1. So we have a case of non-perception in T2 of the T1 object. Well, if non-perception means non-existence, that means the T1 object does not exist at T2. Therefore, we can eliminate the left-hand diagram as a possible view, and we can arrive at the right-hand diagram as the correct view. So it looks like this quasi-idealism has got the Buddhist out of the problem, but again, it seems like there are two possible paths for the Nyayaka. The Nyayaka cannot either argue against this kind of idealism, or they can actually argue that this idealism will not do the job. This is a reminder of the job that needs to be done. This sentence in quotation marks is just repeated from the previous slide. Since the object of perception at T1 is not perceived at T2, we know that it does not exist at T2. That's what the Buddhist is able to establish with the help of this kind of idealism, because the since clause in that sentence, the antecedent, states that the T1 object is not perceived at T2. So that's a claim about non-perception. So if non-perception means non-existence, then we can go from that since antecedent clause to the we know that consequent clause. In other words, we can conclude that the T1 object does not exist at T2. That's how the Buddhist argumentation is working. But the Nyayaka can say it is perceived at T2. The Nyayaka can actually deny the antecedent, can deny that we have a case of non-perception at T1. That we deny that we have a case of non-perception at T2 of the T1 object. How or why? Well, for the Nyayaka, what is perceived at T2 is precisely the object that was perceived at T1. That only is not the case if we assume momentariness. If we assume the object is momentary, then it's true that at T2 we're not perceiving the T1 object. But the Nyayaka shouldn't have to assume momentariness at this point in the argument. So it seems open to the Nyayaka to challenge the antecedent clause, the since clause. The Nyayaka can deny that there is non-perception at T2 of the T1 object. So if there's not a case of non-perception, then the fact that non-perception entails non-existence is irrelevant. So the quasi-idealism is not actually doing the job that it needs to do.
Okay, let me just summarise this section on the Buddhist view, which is now complete. So at one point, the question arose as to how does the Buddhist move from the weaker epistemological claim to the stronger ontological claim? And we saw that the Buddhist appeals to the fact that two consecutive perceptions are always different from each other, and neither of them has access to the other's object. But the Nyayaka responded to that by saying, if that's the case, if neither of them has access to the other's object, then not only would we not be able to know that their objects are the same, we would also not be able to know that their objects are different. If we would not be able to know that their objects are the same, because the T2 perception doesn't have access to the T1 object, then it should also follow that the T2 perception would not be able to know that the T1 object was different. So momentariness has not been proved. We saw then that the Buddhist appealed to this kind of idealism, and then we saw that actually even that idealism looks like it might not be sufficient to do the job. So that's enough about the Buddhist argument. Then it's Jayanta's turn to start speaking in his own voice. For that whole section, there's been a lot of back and forth, as you can see, between the Buddhist and the Nyayaka. But for that first half, which is called the Purvapaksha section, it's always the Buddhist who gets the last say. The Buddhist is given the last speech, the last word. Now we're switching to what's called the Siddhanta section, where Jayanta writes in his own view. And in this section, Jayanta's point of view will get the last word, the last say. Now, Jayanta could have just rested content with arguing that the Buddhist argument fails, that the Buddhist argument is not capable of establishing momentariness. But Jayanta goes further than that. Jayanta comes out all guns blazing and goes to the opposite extreme and argues that actually reflecting on perception can enable us to definitely know the non-momentariness of objects. And how does Jayanta think reflecting on perception can enable us to know that? Well, Jayanta's argument is that in the first moment, an object causes a perception to arise. Then in the next moment, the perception grasps that object. Therefore, the object lasts for at least 2 moments. Let's see what that looks like in a diagram. In T1, the object, denoted by the black line, produces the perception, indicated by the eye, and in the next moment, in T2, the perception grasps that same object which caused it. Therefore, the object existed in T1 as the thing causing the perception, and in T2 as the thing being grasped or perceived. I don't think this argument is going to work either, because it just involves too many presuppositions that the Buddhist will not accept. In the written version of the paper, I give 5 presuppositions that are required for this argument to work, none of which will be accepted by the Buddhist. I'll just give 3 here. First of all, we're dealing with 2 very different models of how perception works. For the Buddhist, perception is kind of like a passive product. It's a bit like a piece of molten wax that used to be put on an envelope to keep the envelope closed and then stamped with a seal. That stamping of the molten wax and leaving the shape of a seal in the molten wax is a bit like, for Buddhism, an object of perception leaving its imprint on perception. Or, this is a bit before most of your time, but a piece of black camera roll in an old camera. When the camera shutter opens and light comes in, the pattern of light leaves an imprint on that black camera roll. So similarly for the Buddhist, perception is just the imprinting of the stream of consciousness with the image of an object. And that model of perception doesn't require non-momentariness in the way that this model of perception does. It just requires that in one moment one object leaves a mark on consciousness, in the next moment another object leaves the mark, and each of those only has to take one moment. So that's the first presupposition, that the Buddhist will not share. The Buddhist will not share this kind of model of how perception works that Jayanta claims, where perception is something rather more active than in the Buddhist model, where perception first of all has to be brought into existence in one moment, and then in the next moment has to actually do something to go and retrieve its content from the external world. First has to come into existence, then has to go and check out the external world to see what's there. The second presupposition that this argument requires is that the cause of perception is the same as the content of perception. That the content of perception in T2 is the same thing that caused the perception. And the Buddhist will not accept that either. The Dharmakirti and Buddhists, who were the target of Jayanta, had two streams in their Dharmakirtian tradition, Sautrantika and Yogacara. To take the Sautrantika model of perception, the claim of the Sautrantikas is that an external object causes the perception, but the content of that perception is not the external object. So the external object causes a perception, but the content of the perception is an image within consciousness. The cause is outside consciousness, the content is within consciousness, so they're not the same thing, so nothing follows from this kind of argument about anything having to exist for more than one moment. The external object just exists for one moment. In its moment of existence, it causes perception. And in the next moment, it's something different which features as the content of perception. We're not dealing with the same non-momentary thing, which is both cause and content. And finally, the only way in which this argument is going to work is if there's been no numerical change from T1 to T2. The Buddhist can accept both of those presuppositions I've just mentioned and say, but yes, there's between T1 and T2, there's numerical change. In T2, the object is something numerically distinct from T1. It's a momentary successor stage to the T1 object, but it's not precisely the same thing as the T1 object. Now, you might think that for the Buddhist to say that is to assume momentariness, and that's quite true. But it doesn't seem as though it's incumbent on the Buddhist at this point to assume non-momentariness. And it looks like this argument is only going to work if we assume non-momentariness, if we assume no numerical change from T1 to T2. So I don't think Jayanta is going to be able to persuade the Buddhist with this argument, because there are too many presuppositions which the Buddhist will not accept. So that's it for Jayanta's argument. I'm not spending as long on that as the Buddhist argument. And now, just to finish up, I don't think then that the Buddhist argument in part one was successful, was able to establish momentariness. I don't think Jayanta's argument in part two was successful, wasn't able to establish non-momentariness against the Buddhist. I think the Nyayika negative argument against the Buddhist was successful, and the Buddhist negative argument against Jayanta was successful. So the positive arguments in favour of their own view don't seem to succeed, but their negative arguments undermining the other do succeed. So it seems to me that the natural position to end up with is that reflecting on perception cannot actually determine whether objects of perception are momentary or persistent, and therefore that we're left with what we could call a kind of middle ground agnosticism. Okay, thanks.
Right. thanks very much, Alex. So we now have several moments for discussion before we...